Gentlemen, are you prepared to begin?
Yes, Your Honor.
Well, we will then go on into session. This is the afternoon session of the Nebraska Court of Appeals. My name is David Arterburn. I am from Papillion, and we are conducting these hearings today through a WebEx link. I am pleased to be joined for this argument by Judge Mike Hurdle from Omaha and by Judge Rico Bishop from Lincoln. Counsel, I would just advise you again that these arguments are being live streamed. So if there is any names or any other type of sensitive information that you wish to not have in the public domain, please just be aware of that. So with that, we will hear the appellant's argument. Mr. Damon.
Thank you. Good afternoon. I'm Greg Damon. I represent the appellant, Erica Jenkins. This case is an appeal from York County District Court. Ms. Jenkins was initially charged with one count of use of a deadly weapon to commit a felony and one count of use of a deadly weapon to commit an assault on a confined person. A jury trial was held. Ms. Jenkins was found guilty of using a deadly weapon to assault a confined person and was found not guilty of use of a deadly weapon to commit a felony. And it's that not guilty finding or verdict that is important for purposes of primarily the jury instruction issue that we've raised in this appeal. And I'll get into that in a moment, but also for some context, I think the court should consider the strength of Ms. Jenkins' defense. I'm certainly well aware that there are cases where due to other evidence or overwhelming evidence of guilt that certain jury instruction issues or other issues in a case may not have much merit. But I believe due to the facts of this case, it was extremely important that the jury be properly instructed. In this case, it was not. Basically, the facts were that Ms. Jenkins and Ms. Bordeaux had been in some jointly undertaken criminal activity. Ms. Bordeaux testified against Ms. Jenkins. Ms. Jenkins was found guilty. Eventually, they both ended up at the York Women's Prison. And eventually, they ended up in the same room together. And eventually, Ms. Bordeaux was assaulted. But it is not as simple as it may appear factually. The assault itself was not on video, although some behavior outside of the room in which the assault occurred was on video. There was conflicting testimony on various points. The bottom line was that our defense was that Ms. Jenkins had not committed an assault, that it was the co-defendant, Ms. Fields, who had committed the assault. And we had significant evidence to indicate that is what occurred. Probably most importantly, there was a lot of evidence that Ms. Fields alone used a padlock to assault Ms. Bordeaux. And that became an issue later with the jury instructions. But basically, the evidence was presented. And when the jury was initially instructed, I believe the jury was properly instructed as to the offense of assault upon a confined person with a deadly weapon. The jury was instructed basically according to a pattern type jury instruction based upon the charge that was filed and the facts. And it included element number 5, the second jury needed to find that Ms. Jenkins used a deadly weapon. And then after that instruction was given during deliberations, the jury came back with a question as to whether that element would be in both count 1 and count 2. At that point, my position was that the instruction had been properly given. There was no request for a lesser included instruction. The judge should have just said, you've been instructed and you need to follow the instructions. As it was, the state asked And I believe it may have been due to some concern about whether the use of the weapon issue was perhaps slipping away from them, but basically changed the instruction or asked the court to change the instruction in the middle of deliberations to enable the jury to basically make a finding that an assault had occurred on a confined person and then make a separate finding for sentencing purposes as to whether a deadly weapon was used. And that's where we have problems with the instruction, was that it just said a deadly weapon was used, said nothing about who used it, whether there was aiding and abetting, that sort of thing.
But there was a separate aiding and abetting instruction, right?
Yes, there was. And it was a general instruction. And that's important because the jury was instructed on aiding and abetting. And in count, I get my counts mixed up, but the other count on use of a deadly weapon to commit a felony, clearly the jury had that aiding and abetting instruction at that point. If the jury believed that Ms. Jenkins aided and abetted Ms. Fields in any way in using a deadly weapon to commit a felony, it would have found her guilty of that charge. So having not found Ms. Jenkins guilty of use of a deadly weapon to commit a felony under either a direct finding or an aiding and abetting theory, then that, to me, creates some real concern about the other count. How could, that's an inconsistent verdict. How can you find that she did not aid and abet the use of a deadly weapon to commit a felony or do that directly, and yet in the sentencing enhancement portion of the other count, find that she did. So I believe that was error. Beyond that common sense notion, I think there's case law in the Supreme Court, the Elaine case, basically addresses these sentencing enhancement issues. And what the Supreme Court says is that if there's an issue like this that increases the defendant's sentence, that's a jury question, a Sixth Amendment right to a jury determination. And it becomes an element of the case that must be charged in the indictment.
Mr. Damon, I'm sorry, Judge Bishop, I interrupted you.
No, go ahead. I can tell you've been waiting to jump in here, so go ahead.
Mr. Damon, a couple of things. First of all, the initial instruction was basically given in the words of the information. It alleged the offense as the information did, correct?
Yes.
And then as you answered earlier, there was an aiding and abetting instruction. So Ms. Jenkins could have been found guilty based on aiding and abetting somebody else assaulting with a deadly weapon, had there been no changes. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. So how does the new instruction change that?
Well, I think the new instruction enabled the jury to find that Ms. Jenkins was guilty of assault on a confined person using a deadly weapon without, they could find that just because the deadly weapon was used by Ms. Field. And
could they not have done that previously?
Well, I think it potentially they could have, but I think the way it was worded with the instruction, given the facts of the case and the finding on the other count, that to me it's pretty clear the jury was confused.
All right.
I think that it's possible under these facts, and remember this incident went on for about 45 minutes with people going in and out of a room, and I think it's possible that the jury could have concluded that these were separate assaults, that Ms. Fields committed her assault upon Ms. Bordeaux and that Ms. Jenkins committed her own assault. I know there's testimony from Bordeaux that they acted together, but I think there's also some evidence that Ms. Bordeaux had some credibility issues. There's also evidence that Ms. Fields had more of a reason recently because of some conflict between the two of them to have committed an assault like this. So it's confusing, and it's hard even, I think, for the lawyers to really wrap their heads around this. I can't imagine what a jury maybe was thinking. I think the jury instruction could have easily been clarified. Beyond that, I believe that really this, to begin with, is a lesser included offense issue, that if, because assault on a confined person is a lesser included offense of assault on a confined person with a deadly weapon.
Do you know of any authority that allows a court to give, in essence, a lesser included offense instruction midstream while the jury is deliberating?
No, I think that's a strategy decision that counsel makes at the time the case is submitted to the jury. And it's usually the defendant who wants to maybe make the strategy decision to perhaps have an all or nothing verdict and will not ask for the lesser included or ask that it not be given. And so that was part of my objection. I believe that it changes the nature of the defense a little bit also. That's more of a charging issue. If it's not charged in the alternative as aiding and abetting, defendant prepares with the assumption that the state's going to try to prove that they in fact committed the crime.
But Mr. Damon, didn't the state in their brief points us to State versus Contreras, which addresses that it's unnecessary to include in the charging information aiding and abetting. And so doesn't that case address that issue in terms of it not being specifically alleged in the information here?
Well, I think that case needs to be revisited in light of Elaine that the U.S. Supreme Court decided in 2013, because that case makes clear that sentencing issues such as this are jury decisions.
Well, but in Elaine or Elaine, I'm not sure how to say it, but I call it Elaine. They talk about the difference between elements, right, that a jury has to find beyond a reasonable doubt, and sentencing factors. And in Elaine, in that case for sure, the jury did not decide that brandishing issue, right? They decided a firearm was used, but they did not address whether it had been brandished. In this case, we're talking about whether there was an assault on a confined person, and then additionally, whether or not a deadly or dangerous weapon was used. And so in this case, the jury did decide the element in this offense, because the jury, not the judge, decided that a weapon had been used, right? So I'm seeing some distinction between what a lien represents and what we have here in this case.
Well, the best way I can answer that is that there's yet a further distinction in the facts you gave, in that it's an aiding and abetting issue that's not thrown in on top of that. And so it's really the aiding and abetting that has the potential to increase the sentence. And that's what that case was trying to avoid, is, you know, that becomes an element then, according to my reading of that case. Aiding and abetting then becomes an element if that's what the state is relying upon. So it should have been charged. All right. I see I'm out of time.
Yeah. Judge Pirtle or Judge Bishop, do you have any other questions?
No.
No, thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Damon. Mr. Ralph.
He's still muted.
You need to, there we go. Oh, now you're muted again.
There we go. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes.
May it please the court. My name is Austin Ralph. I represent the state of Nebraska. Several issues on appeal here, but I'll just go ahead and jump into the jury instruction issue. That appears to be the primary issue for this court. In short, we don't really see any problem with what happened in the trial court. There is authority that allows the district court to add, supplement, exchange instructions even after Deliberations have begun. I would cite this court to State v. Hudson. Let me get the cite here. 277 Neb 182, 2009 case from the Nebraska Supreme Court. This court in State v. Graves as well said that it was appropriate for a court is authorized by statute to give additional instructions after the jury has begun deliberations. And then State v. Smith, a 2012 case in the Nebraska Supreme Court, also said a court may give a lesser included instruction over a defendant's objection. So we don't see any issue with
that. The unique thing in this case, though, is that in essence, a lesser included instruction is being given after the case goes to the jury. Have you found a case where there's an example of that happening, where the elements are being changed?
Well, I believe the State v. Robinson, 278, Nebraska, 212, 2009. I might have to take a look at that. I have to look at that case again. That might be one this court would be interested in. But I think the propositions of law clearly exist that a district court is allowed to give supplemental or additional instructions to the jury that would include a lesser included offense instruction. And they can do that after deliberations if it's requested. I would also point, I think, to what Your Honor was getting at, Judge Arterburn, about it being harmless error, in that, okay, they gave him the option for a lesser included. They didn't find her guilty of the lesser included. They found her guilty of the assault by a confined person with a deadly weapon. So I'm not sure what the error would be if it was improper to give the lesser included offense instruction, which we maintain, you know, was not an issue. As far as the Aline, I agree with Judge Bishop. It's not applicable here in my view. Aline really was focused on the jury versus judge factual determinations. Here, the jury obviously decided all the issues, all the factual issues. I don't think it would really be aiding and abetting would really be an element, as Mr. Damon suggests, primarily because it's not a fact that increases the punishment. It's just simply treating an aider and abetter the same as a principal. The statutory punishment remains the same. So I don't think it would be an element under Aline's reasoning. And like I said, I don't see how it would be applicable here where the jury found the aiding and abetting or that she acted as a principal.
Mr. Ralph, do you recall if in the State v. Hudson or State v. Graves cases that you referred us to, were those cases situations as is here where the jury instructions were supplemented or substituted or whatever in response to a jury question?
I do not believe, I do not remember, Your Honor, I'm sorry about that.
Does it make a difference? I mean, does our standard of review in reviewing jury instructions that are alleged to have been incorrect is one, right? We have an independent review of that. But when we have reviewed a court's response to a jury's question, we look at that for an abuse of discretion. So this is kind of an interesting mix. We have a jury question that prompts the court and the attorneys to modify or, you know, adjust the instructions.
Sure. I mean, ultimately, I think we're still reviewing the supplemental instruction or the amended instruction for the same deficiency or alleged deficiency that an ordinary instruction would have. And that is whether it, you know, properly states the law or, you know, somehow other, you know, improperly prejudices him. The State v. Robinson case that I cited to you talks about how a supplemental instruction is viewed the exact same as an ordinary instruction. And so here, even if it were improper to give that supplemental or substitute instruction, I don't see where the error would be because, as I said in my brief, it's a correct statement of the law. It's a lesser included offense that would be aggravated, enhanced, what have you, by the finding of fact regarding the use of a deadly weapon, perfectly consistent with the statute, consistent with the charging. State v. Contreras allows it, says it's implied. And as I argued earlier, I don't think Aline has any applicability here. So even if it were error to give the instruction at the time it did, I don't see what the problem or what the prejudice would be under those principles.
Do you see, as Mr. Damon has alleged, do you see an inconsistency in acquitting on count two, but convicting on count one, or finding her guilty on count one?
Yeah, I mean, I think it probably is an inconsistent verdict. While I don't have an explanation for it, I can't tell why the jury did it. Maybe it was because they wanted to give Ms. Jenkins the same, or you know, roughly the same treatment as Ms. Fields. Maybe they, you know, looked at that. Maybe they, you know, did find that Ms. Fields was the one using the lock, but the aiding and abetting instruction 13, actually only refers to the assault by confined person in terms of aiding and abetting. So maybe they applied it just to the assault charge and not the use of a deadly weapon charge. I don't know. But the fact of an inconsistent verdict really has no applicability here, where, you know, the assigned error is just a jury instruction issue. And, you know, we're not probing into the minds of the jurors to determine why they decided to find guilty on one and not the other. The evidence that, you know, suggested, and they probably should have found her guilty of both, but they did not on the use of a weapon. I don't know why. So I guess in sum on this particular issue, the jury instruction we thought that was amended was given properly. Lesser included, or you're impliedly charged with the lesser included when you're charged with a greater offense. So you didn't need the explicit language in the information. A district court is given authority by statute to amend or supplement instructions even after deliberations has begun. That's what happened here. The supplemental instruction was a correct statement of the law, so I see no prejudice, even if it was error. So for that reason, we think that assignment of error has no merit.
If I can, before you leave that topic, if the question from the jury was simply went to count one, is that correct?
I think it was a two-part question. I think they said, you know, is this section five supposed to be included on count one, or is it only supposed to be on count two, the use of a deadly weapon part? I'd have to look at my notes to double check that, but basically it was, is the use of a deadly weapon part of the elements instruction four, was that supposed to be there, or was it supposed to only be in count two?
Okay. All right. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Nope. No problem. As far as the other issues, unless this court has questions, I would submit on the brief. It's an abuse of discretion standard of review, and based on my review of the record, I don't think that we can say that the district court's reasoning was clearly erroneous or clearly untenable in overruling the motion for mistrial or the foundation objection.
With regard to the mistrial, was there a question asked during the voir dire after it became known that there had been these discussions outside the presence of the court and the lawyers? Was there a general question asked to find out how many people had heard any of these discussions?
I don't believe so. I think the jury selection, the voir dire, continued individually for the most part. And they just asked, they didn't question every juror. They questioned a significant number, but I don't know offhand. And those jurors, you know, explained, you know, three or four people had been talking. Several of them said they hadn't overheard anything. Others said, you know, that they had. So it was.
Was there opportunity for all the attorneys to ask that question to the panel as a whole? Question, meaning, you know, I know a number of people were brought in individually, but was there a general panel after that where everyone would have had the opportunity to ask that question?
I think so, but I can't be sure on that. I'd have to look at the Bill of Exceptions again. But I think the jury panel was called back in after the individual voir dire. But again, I'd have to check the Bill of Exceptions. It's been a while since I looked at that.
I need to refresh my memory on that as well.
All right. But yeah, as far as those other two issues, we're comfortable submitting on the brief. Unless this court has further questions, I'd ask that you affirm the judgment.
Any other questions from the panel?
Not for me, thank you.
All right, all right. Thank you, Mr. Damon and Mr. Ralph. The case will be submitted at this time, and we will issue a decision. You're excused.